Welcome to the Christchurch London podcast. This is a talk from our Sutton service. To find out about upcoming talks at each of our services, or to listen to other talks, please visit christchurchlondon.org.
This whole thing with Thomas. So, first of all, we've got facts. Historical sources, maybe when we're talking about the Christian faith. The Bible, contemporary writers. We've got our practice. That could be our traditions, whether that's the traditions of the early church, whether that's traditions that we have nowadays, whether that's what we do in church, whether that's the leaders that we listen to, the people that we decide to take their word for things. All of those things form our practice. And then thirdly, we've got our experience, which is inalienable to us. It's what we have known ourselves. So let's quickly try and unpack these as we go through, and I'm losing track of time. So first of all, facts. The historical sources of the Bible. This is a fundamental tenet of faith in Jesus, that we know Jesus actually existed. This happened, his crucifixion happened that we were looking at last week. And we know that not just from the Bible, though it is possibly the most extraordinary set of ancient books available in this world, reporting something happening at the time with multiple different viewpoints on the same things happening. But we have contemporary non-Christian writers. You've got Josephus, you've got Tacitus, Jesus is mentioned in the Jewish Talmud, and many other places. He was real and he was crucified, and that is accepted as fact, other than by a small bunch of lunatic fringe. And of particular relevance to Jesus is that the New Testament, and the Gospels in particular, came later than lots of the other letters within the book. This was people trying to record the biography of Jesus, so that there would be an avoidance of doubt later on, that you could actually look back and say, these things happened. And just two passages I want to bring up. First one is how Luke starts his gospel. He says this: many have undertaken to draw upon an account of the things that have happened and been fulfilled amongst us, just as they were handed down to us by those from whom first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. And when he says word, he means Jesus. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. And the Gospel of John, just after what we have already looked at with the story of Thomas, says this: Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which were not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus was the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Our faith is based in a historical reality here. That is an evidence we can draw upon. Secondly, practice. Now, we've all got our own traditions. I grew up in a pretty dull, run-of-the-mill Anglican church in the middle of the countryside, so in many ways it's a miracle that I'm still standing here before, because it did not teach me any of the joys of faith. But one summer, shortly after my parents separated, my mum was thinking, what can I do with this sort of 12-year-old child to keep him entertained? And she chose to go to a Christian holiday centre in North Devon. And it was there that I had the first experience that faith could be different. Combined with the stuff I had learnt within that Anglican context, I got to see that this faith was a robust one. I also got to see that I could experience relationship with God. And as we grow up, both in age and in our sort of understanding, our faith becomes more sophisticated. We start bringing in interpretations of what other people think, who will be very trusted, the books we read, the speakers we listen to. And in essence, the basis for our faith starts to broaden out to the interpretations that others want to give. And that's no bad thing. We get to build upon the wisdom of others and the thoughts of others. But in one way, that becomes a key standing block of our faith too. And to some degree, the evidence that we use to hold faith ourselves. So the disciples in the early church, they had their own traditions back then, which are in part recorded in the letters in the New Testament, where they get to allude to how the church is starting to build those things and those practices day in, day out that would help them understand what faith was, would educate the next generation. And it's then that the Gospels are written, often after that, so that there would be that basis to be able to make sense of those traditions, so they did not become separated from the truth of the reality, of the facts that had actually inspired them in the first place. And on the back of that, all the disciples who gather around Jesus, they go to their deaths proclaiming that this Jesus has been resurrected, has appeared to them, and appeared to many more. And that is something that we can base our trust in. And when they say resurrected, they mean in his body, as we're going to come to. And contemporary historians will look at this too. I loved the book Dominion by Tom Holland. It is a masterful book, but he is a very popular secular historian. And he traces the impact of the early church fathers, and early faith into how that makes the world today. And this is what he says. He says, so profound has been the impact of Christianity on the development of Western civilization that it has come to be hidden from view. It is the incomplete revolutions which are remembered. The fate of those which triumph is taken for granted. This extraordinary situation of a man being resurrected, coming back from dead, and people going and telling people, not only went against the cultures of the day where power was paramount, and actually this idea that your God would have died would have been grotesque, would have made somebody feel ill, think like, I can't go near that. Yet this triumphs over all of the prevailing paradigms of the day that said this is what is important. That's where we stand now, with that as our history, is that as our practice, that as our tradition. And thirdly, experience. This third building block of faith is how we get to experience Jesus today. And it is crucial because Jesus promised that he would be with us. He would give us his spirit. And that promise to us as Christians is not only that we get to have a relationship with one another in front of God, but we'd have one directly with himself. As a child, I used to get scared at night and had to sleep with the light on. And one night, I remember going into the toilet. Again, I was probably about 11 or 12, because I was struggling to sleep. And I sat down on the toilet. And it's the only time in my life, but I felt God speak to me so powerfully. This voice inside my head that said, you're coming to me soon. And I was scared. I was on the toilet. I want to make a joke, but I'll let you go there yourself. I was terrified, and I ran down the corridor to my mum, and I got into my mum's bed going, I'm going to die. I think God just spoke to me and said, I'm coming to you soon. I'm going to die. I might have been a little bit of a hypochondriac, and if you're lucky and I get to preach again, I'll probably share more stories of how things like I pretended to be blind to get out of going to school and things like that. It's quite special. But my mum calmed me down. She was able to put me back on track. I put my faith in Mum that she would be able to help me in that situation, and she did. She helped me overcome those fears and those doubts inside of me after what I thought I'd heard. And it was later that summer that I got to discover who Jesus was, as we've just talked about. Who Jesus was to me. I got, if you were here when Hannah was speaking a few weeks ago, talking about knowing God, not knowing just ideas about God or facts about God, knowing God himself. That is what happened that summer, and my mum and I would reflect on this. That maybe actually what God had said there in that rather mad midnight sort of thing was something of him calling me. That was a crucial experience in my life. Now, this unique balance of these three, and we'll come back to the next slide, it might change over time, it flexes. You know, maybe one of them you really struggle with at one point, facts, practice, or experience, and it can kind of feel like it's pulled away, but you can survive in a short period of time. But if one of those tenets dies, your faith will die too, ultimately. It will either become nothing or it will go off into craziness. Now let's think a little bit about the other side, about doubt. John Ortberg, who, if Andy was here, John Ortberg, other than Lord of the Rings, is his favourite source of theological wisdom. He's written a book called No Doubt, and he describes the role of doubt and faith as this. It struck me how deeply both faith and doubt are part of my life. We often think of them as opposites. Many books argue for one or the other, but while in some respects they are enemies, in other ways they are surprisingly alike. Both are concerned with ultimate issues, which is true. That was my interpretation. Both pop up unasked for at unexpected moments. Both are necessary. So first of all, let's consider necessary doubt. Now, healthy doubt can be linked with humility. It might mean that we're not always right in everything. We don't have all the answers, which Pat is very good at reminding me of on a regular basis. Thank you. I appreciate you very much. It can call us to wrestle with God, wonder what he is doing, help us better understand by being in the trenches with him and drawing closer and learning something deep from him. Doubt can also protect us from being overly credulous. When someone says something, oh, God says so, oh, of course God says so, I'll believe it. That might not necessarily be the truth. And there is literally loads of our life as Christians and words and sayings we have that are like that. And we can hold on to them. Oh, that must be true. But actually, when you look at them, there isn't really anything there. See, faith without doubt is certainty. There's no space for anything else. For faith to be meaningful, there has to be the option of it not being the case. So we have to have doubts. But then we have unhelpful doubts too. And if left unchecked, doubt can grow into something more. And I've seen several ways that doubt has unraveled faith. For some people, I've seen maybe that's in the Bible. Many people who've grown up maybe understanding Genesis as being a literal scientific account of creation. And I appreciate in saying this, there will be lots of different views in this room, so hold with me. It will be okay. They might struggle to have that view challenged by science, or even a modern Christian understanding of what that means in terms of the language that is being spoken about, whether it's allegorical or not. It can lead people saying, well, can the Bible be trusted? What if that first bit can't be trusted? What else can be trusted? Oh no, this is all going to fall apart like some kind of house of cards. Have we interpreted right? Maybe you could have doubts in the traditions of faith. Maybe you've been harmed by Christians, churches, or things that you've heard or seen in the media, or you've heard leaders say. See, we're never far away from stories of moral or spiritual failure in the church, whether that's people that we once looked up to, like Ravi Zacharias, or the rise and fall of Miles Hill, if you've been listening to that podcast, or what's going on in Hillsong at the moment. We can see leaders who we've trusted, whether or not we've known them, they've become part of that idea of our faith. It turns out they've not been the saints we hoped they would be, and our faith can really take a hit, even though it's got nothing really to do with Jesus. Maybe we can have doubts because of your experience. You've been dealing with suffering close up. You've seen pain, and you're unable to reconcile that pain with this view of a loving God that you've been taught. God won't give you more than you can handle, maybe you've heard that say. But I think we can say time and time again where that is obviously not true. It's a lie. And it hurts. I remember when my mum was suffering with various illnesses. And she asked me if I thought that the reason that she wasn't being healed was because of a lack of faith. And she'd been listening to some pastor who said that was why. And I remember being so frustrated with that. I mean, hey, why shouldn't she be healed? She was deserving of healing as the next person. But how could someone go off with their teaching in the name of Christ, damaging someone's faith, thinking, did what they have, was it enough? And I remember being so angry the night that she died, calling my best friend and kind of shouting down the phone to him, saying, this all better be real. I was hurting, I was grieving, but I was also doubting. I was doubting actually like never before. Any of these kind of doubts can become the thread that can unravel the garment of faith if we're not careful. People can deconstruct and walk away from faith because they can feel too hurt to approach it again, whether or not it was true or not. So when we experience doubts, how we respond to them is going to be really important. But equally important is how we experience doubts with somebody else who is going through them. And I think that's something where I want to come back to Thomas here now. There are some things that this passage we've looked at teaches about how to doubt and how to work with those who are. What I really like about this passage I'm preparing is Thomas doesn't seem as hard set against Jesus as maybe I'd initially thought at first reading. I see someone who wants to really know if Jesus is true. He wants to be sure he's putting his faith in the right thing, not just because his friends have told him something. Evidence is important, and that's not a bad thing. He's not just going along with the group to fit in. That would be really short-lived. He does not doubt in silence. If you're doubting, don't doubt in silence. He also thinks he knows what evidence he needs to be convinced. He knows that, and he communicates that. He's honest with his struggle. If you're doubting, please be honest with those around you. Thirdly, he's not withdrawing. He's still there a week later. I imagine that was a pretty tough week for Thomas, with all the rest of the disciples saying something, and he was probably feeling fairly hurt by all that. But he's still open, and he's still in community. What strikes me is that Thomas is actually really a scared and a hurt man, probably arguing with his friends, feeling left out, that he was the only one who didn't see Jesus. Why me? Don't we ask that often? Why me? And also maybe he's called Didymus, the twin. It's a weird thing to put in there, but maybe as a twin, this is the first time he's felt like, I haven't got somebody with me. I feel really alone. Who knows? Or that's a deep current for any of you who are twins, probably would say that. So that's why he's in a state of doubt. He's maybe getting closer to not believing, but he's still holding out hope. He's still got some faith. And how does Jesus respond to him? He enters when all the doors are closed. I mean, that's some entrance, right? Like, there we go. But he comes speaking peace. He operates with gentleness. He doesn't tell Thomas off, though maybe he could have done. How could you think that? How foolish of you not to believe in me. But Jesus actually offers him his wounds for him to touch. And this feels, despite the fact Jesus has just conquered death, this is a risen Savior who's victorious over everything, this feels a deeply vulnerable thing for Jesus to do to Thomas, a deeply intimate thing to do that maybe didn't have to be done to prove something. But out of care and love for Thomas, he wants to meet his needs. And in this, Thomas is rehabilitated. He's now back with the rest of the disciples who also believed when they saw. He's just the same as the rest of them. Maybe he feels back. But for Thomas, this doubt wasn't just an empirical, I need to see these facts to prove this. He didn't just need evidence and a compelling argument. There's also this deeply emotional aspect to it. And I think that is what is true of all of us. Our doubts are deeply emotional. So for us sitting with somebody in doubt, I think we need to do the same. We need to reject the temptation to turn to answers and arguments. We need to sit with gentleness. We need to hear their doubts. We need to recognize the emotion behind them. And we need to be vulnerable with them. And only then offer something. My friend, who I mentioned then that I shouted down the phone at, there's this letter that I found in the garage recently. He was writing this to me because he knew my mum was really ill. And there are these two paragraphs I just want to read to you. He said, "And so at this really hard time, I want to encourage you to remember Christ, his words and power, his love and suffering, his tears and his saving of our humanity, of his sacrificial sin, having beating death in our place, all of this triumph over evil, even our last enemy death. I want to remind you and encourage you with his great and precious promises." Then it says, "Jimmy, you've just rang, and I don't know what to say. I've reread my letter. I hope you don't mind that I've left what I've already written and continue here. I'm reminded of Paul's words at the beginning of 2 Corinthians 1, 3 to 4, and I pray that you would know the comfort and compassion of God, of all comfort at this time. May he grant you the strength to face each day and give you real hope in the time of deep grief." And he goes on. What I loved about that is he was talking to me first with almost the facts, trying to remember me of things. And I'm putting on another phone, he picks up his pen and continues with something that says, "I see you, not I'm going to tell you just the answers that you need to hear." And to me that felt like what Jesus was doing with Thomas. So we're coming in to land in a bit. How do you feel today? I wonder if you're feeling like one of those disciples who'd heard the women and believed, and maybe that's your story, and that's great. Or maybe you feel a bit like Thomas, wanting to be believed, but not sure if you can trust the people around you and what they're telling you. Maybe too, you want to believe, but actually you don't trust yourself enough, because if I believe it, it must be too good for you, because I'm always wrong. Maybe you've got self-doubt there. Or maybe you're just unsure of what to believe and you want to demand proof. What we've looked at today, that there is proof there, there is evidence that we can look at, but still demands something beyond evidence about what it means in our hearts. And this story of Thomas, this is approaching the climax of the Gospel of John. And like any good biopic, or if you imagine this was a film of Jesus' life, it's starting to draw together all the strands that had been opened earlier in the story. This is like the penultimate scene, the battle scene where everything is being sorted. There is one more scene, like that end one. You know, just before the film ends, you think it's all finished and it's really soft and sepia tones. That's coming. That's miraculous catch of fish. That's Peter being rehabilitated. But this is the big one. You see, because John starts out his gospel saying, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Jesus is the Logos, the Greek for Word. And at the end of this gospel, here we are, Jesus is appearing before Thomas. We have the Word coming back, and the Word being put to the test. Is the Word real? Is Jesus really God made flesh? So Thomas starts with this empirical need. I need to do these things to believe that Jesus has risen from the dead. But the evidence he gets transcends that, takes him to a whole new place. And to me, this is really the heart of this sort of nexus of faith and doubts. It's ultimately a really relational, a really emotional question. Thomas knew Jesus because he had been his disciple for years. He'd followed him, he'd observed him, he's tried to learn from him in his day to day. But like all of the other disciples, he doesn't really know Jesus. I wonder whether the belief that Jesus wanted to see from Thomas was not that he could believe when he's presented with evidence and come to some sort of rational conclusion, but rather because of the time they had spent together and all that Thomas had seen, he would be able to hear of Jesus' resurrection and say, absolutely, because that's exactly the kind of thing that my Jesus would do. I think Jesus wants Thomas to have faith because he knows him, not because he can process evidence. Maybe the band would like to come back up. There's this extraordinary grace and gentleness in Jesus towards Thomas that sees these doubts transformed. And this transcendent response is not just, you're alive, I now believe you came back from the dead. No, it's not. It's my Lord and my God. The penny has dropped for Thomas. The empirical has become the emotional. For Thomas, seeing Jesus rise from the dead proves to him, yes, he has come back from the dead, but oh, so much more. That he is able to carry all of Thomas's hopes. He's able to carry all his dreams, his life, his future. Jesus is his God. And Thomas will go off around the world sharing this news. He'll go to India, as tradition had it, and giving his life for this news. And this is the faith that we can have in face of doubts. So whether you're struggling with whatever it is, parts of the Bible, you're struggling with things in your own life, and maybe you don't want to admit it because none of us ever really do. Whether you're doubting because of grief or disappointment or despair, you can put your faith not in a theology that says, if you do this, and if you believe that, and if you don't doubt, well, then you'll be okay. But instead, you get to put your faith in Jesus, in God himself, who lived amongst us as humans, who knew the joy of friendship, who knew what it was like to be a child growing up with parents caring for him, who knew the pain of injustice, who knew death. Jesus is who we put our faith in as Christians. The Bible, our traditions, our experiences, we need all of them. But they are just, they're not the destination themselves. They are just waypoints on the way towards Jesus, who is who we have faith in. He is the whole point of the Bible. Worship engagement with him is why the traditions of the early church, that's what they sought to establish, because this man who had died and come back to dead in full body talked to them about the promise that was come, that they had a hope and a future. Knowledge of him is why the gospel writers like John wanted to make sure this was passed to the next generation. So Thomas ends by saying, my Lord, my God. This is the only time in the gospel where Jesus is directly called God, where the disciples come to worship him because they recognize that he is divine himself. So, shall we stand? And we're going to respond in the same way in worship to Jesus, because he is the one who can soothe our doubts. He's the one who can heal our pain. He can restore us and carry our hopes and dreams to the future. This is Jesus. This is our Lord. And this is our God.